crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. We're coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm very glad that you have listened in, just because we have a special show ahead. Earlier this week, Christopher Eames and I had the opportunity to interview the director of the Shiloh excavations. He's the provost of the Bible Seminary in Houston. His name is Dr. Scott Stripling. You may have heard of him. He's quite famous in the archaeological world, especially of late, because of his excavations at Shiloh, one of the most important cities in biblical Israel's history. And so what I thought we would do today for the program is keep it simple and just play you the entirety of this interview. He returned recently, just over a week ago, from Israel back to the United States, and he's going to report on the latest season's finding for us. So here is the interview with Dr. Scott Stripling. All right, Dr. Scott Stripling, thank you very much for coming to the show or coming on the show with us. We do appreciate your time, especially in light of the fact that we are doing these series on the Bible and seeing how the artifacts, the archaeology stacks up with the biblical narrative at each of these different cities around ancient Israel. And so you are the director of the Shiloh excavations, and so we get to hear about Shiloh directly from you. So we're very excited about that. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thanks. It's an honor to be with you, and I look forward to discussing my favorite topic.
Yeah, I've seen that you've done a number of interviews of late. You've got something coming up on the 700 Club, I guess, later on. Is that possibly in a couple weeks or so, week and a half? So that's great publicity for this excavation. A lot of people are interested in Shiloh, and that gets back to, of course, its history being rooted in the very beginning of the Israelite nation once they come into the Promised Land. I wonder, though, first, if you could just talk about the excavation this past season, how many people were involved, maybe some of the key takeaways that you had before we kind of go back into talking about the biblical history.
Okay, absolutely. We had 145 registered volunteers this summer. So that makes us the largest dig in Israel, and I think the largest dig in the Middle East right now.
Yeah, that's huge.
Those are big numbers. We also had a number of day volunteers and groups that worked with us, as well as my Israeli staff and so forth. So, you know, depending on how you look at it, we had over 200 people participating in the excavation. So we were able to accomplish quite a bit.
So with this excavation, I see that you're working with the Associates for Biblical Research as well. And so you've got a lot of people coming over from the United States. Mainly, I would say, internationally from there, but you do have others from, I think, Europe and Scandinavia and, sure, and such. But as far as the Israeli workers on the site, is that limited to staff, or do you have Israeli volunteers as well?
Occasionally, we'll have Israeli volunteers or a work crew that I can bring in for a specific project. Let's say that there's a wall that I want to disassemble. you know, I may bring in a crew of local workers to do that specific project. But normally when I have Israelis working with me, they're part of the staff. Either they're a graduate student or they're a professor at one of the local universities that we're partnering with. For example, at Ben-Gurion University, they work with our flints. So, you know, of course, being down in the Negev, they're experts with flint. At Ariel University, we're partnering with them on ceramic reconstruction. At Hebrew University, we use their scanners for our pottery reconstruction, pottery reading and drawing and so forth. So we partner with a number of the different universities, not to mention some of the specialists like our numismatist or our zooarchaeologist or our anthropologist. So they're all popping in and out sort of, you know, every few days in the dig to touch base with what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's just wonderful to have such a worldwide influence on this excavation, and getting the Israeli experts involved is important definitely as well. Maybe you could talk about maybe the finding that was most impressive to you. Of course, this is your third season or second season?
Second season at Shiloh.
Second season at Shiloh. Of course, you've worked for 20 years, a bit further south than that, and then you've been excavating forever. We can't talk about that. But you bring that experience to Shiloh, which is great because it is a site that has a lot of, I would say, some controversy surrounding it. And so you can bring your expertise to it, which is wonderful. So what would be one of the key findings of this past season for you?
Well, as you can imagine, there were numerous important findings with the 12 archaeological squares that we were working on the northern slope. So we're exposing the inside of the massive fortification wall where all the storage rooms are, the top of the wall, and then the outside of the wall. And so I'll just note a couple of important ones. We uncovered the glacis, which is an earthen embankment that protects the foundation of a fortification system in the Bronze Age. And these are very rare to have intact sections of glacis, and ours is just absolutely beautiful. And there's more of it in the surrounding squares that we're going to be able to expose in the coming season. So it's right next to the path that tourists are going to be walking by. So it's just an ideal way for people to, there'll be nice signage there. They'll be able to see the glacis and then understand how it worked in biblical times. But probably the biggest finding, I think, from everything else would be a ceramic pomegranate, and probably 20 centimeters or so high. And the pomegranate is, of course, a motif of the tabernacle in the temple. Priests wore pomegranates on the hems of their garment. And ours, by the way, has a little hole where it can be hung. And so when we're talking about a site like Shiloh, of course, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is foremost in everyone's mind. And so when one is excavating through a material culture that dates to that time period and then uncovers a ceramic pomegranate, this grabs one's attention, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And so I predict that this will be a pretty major find.
Yeah, it would be, because obviously there's been excavations that have happened throughout the last century at Shiloh to varying degrees. Israel Finkelstein excavated there in the early 80s. And then there hasn't been a real substantial excavation since the mid-80s, if I'm not mistaken, till your time. There was some smaller excavations.
Yes.
But the main thing that people are going to associate with Shiloh by going to the Bible is this being the religious center of Israel when just after Joshua takes the promised land, they set up the tabernacle, as you say. And so the search is on for the tabernacle. But realistically, what can we expect to find in Shiloh of the tabernacle?
Okay, well, that's a very good question. Of the tabernacle proper, we don't expect to find much because it's made of animal skins and there are wooden poles and so forth. However, the Bible does discuss sockets that are made of silver, bronze, and gold, and hooks that are made of these various materials as well. And then the accoutrements, things like pomegranates, for example, and even remnants of the altar. Saint Jerome, who was there in the 5th century at Shiloh, said that he still was able to see the altar in his day. And so, you know, there were some permanent things, and they may even be found in secondary usage, which right. is not uncommon. But the structure itself, unless it has transitioned into a permanent building, which is, of course, from the Hebrew language in 1 Samuel 3 and 4, a distinct possibility. We start getting language about, instead of the curtains of the tabernacle, now we're talking about the doors of the tabernacle and so forth. So if it's a permanent structure of some kind that's built, well, then that we may be all in for quite a surprise.
For sure. And I think it would be also, just thinking about the area that the tabernacle itself and then also the surrounding courtyard, I guess, if I can call it that, that perhaps must have been in a flat area or flat-ish area. So maybe there would be something left in bedrock somehow. Have you thought about, I guess you've definitely thought about that. Is there some evidence of an area where you think that the tabernacle probably stood?
Well, my view is that the tabernacle was probably mobile at Shiloh and not affixed at one spot. It's a tent. So the whole purpose is that it's mobile. It's been moving for 40 years. Over time, there's a large buildup of bone deposits and just disposing of the unpleasant remains from the sacrificial system becomes a problem hygienically and just with the smell. Let's say seasonally, as the wind is changing directions, in my view, they probably relocated the tabernacle. So we should see all of Shiloh as a temenos, as a sacred spot, with the tabernacle moving around the site. Now, to answer your question specifically, there are many who believe that on the northern platform, more or less fits the dimensions. It's flat outside the wall, however, which could be a problem. But, you know, there are some cut marks in the bedrock that one could theorize that these were used for the placement of the tabernacle. And they very well may have been. I'm just saying, let's not think that it was exclusively in that spot.
Yeah, it does make sense. If you're going to have a lot of animal bones, as you say, and the smell changing with the winds, yeah, that would be unpleasant in many ways. It does make sense to move it around. As far as you keep on talking about the period in which you're digging, I wonder if you can relate to the archaeological period. Obviously, we need to find the right stuff at the right during the right time for it to relate to this biblical event. And so which period are we looking at? What are the years as well associated with the time that the tabernacle was there?
That's an excellent question. If we're looking in the wrong time, in the wrong place, we're certain to find the wrong stuff. So yeah, let's sort of lay this out biblically and then in archaeological terms.
Great.
Biblically, we're talking about the period of the conquest, which would begin taking the biblical date of 1 Kings 6:1 and Judges 11:26, this would put an entrance into Israel in about 1406. That would mean an arrival at Shiloh in about 1399, so in the early 14th century BC. Now, in archaeological terms, we refer to this as the Late Bronze Period, so specifically the Late Bronze I period, and then it's my view that it continues in usage at Shiloh through the Late Bronze II period and on into the Iron I period, which is the period of the Judges. So altogether about three centuries from, like I said, early 14th century BC down to maybe early 12th century or early 11th century rather BC.
So if you say you're digging around the massive exterior wall, the city wall, this latest season, this city wall would date to which one of those periods?
Okay, that's what we would call MB2C or MB3. So the middle bronze 2C or MB3 is what we would refer to it. So that is in layman's terms about 1700 to 1650 BC is when it was constructed. And there was a building boom in the southern Levant, in Israel and Jordan and so forth. Around that same time. So we find the same type of construction at many sites, Shechem, for example, Jerusalem, and many other sites. Big building boom with very, very large construction.
And so that's obviously pre the biblical narrative. Did this city wall continue in use throughout into the Israelite period, or did they construct their own wall?
No. This is the wall that Joshua and the Israelites would have seen, and then they continued to use. So remember, one of the great promises that God made them was that you're going to live in cities you did not build. You're going to occupy houses that you did not construct. We're talking about massive generational wealth. This is a transfer of generational wealth. It's infrastructure, for crying out loud. So, I mean, this is enormous financial transfer that takes place. So the Israelites continue to use the same structures. We even have in the storage rooms at the lowest level, we have Bronze Age storage jars. And then above that, we have what we call collared rim jars or Israelite period storage jars. So clearly they're using the same structures. Now, it's my view that as far as domestically, they're still living in tents for the most part. They are still very much semi-nomadic, and yet they may have some very simple structures, or they're living in the old Canaanite, Amorite houses. But especially at Shiloh, as long as God is living in a tent, I think they continue to live in tents.
That's kind of like, what David said, right? He looks around, exactly. He's like, why am I living, or why have I got this beautiful house, and you're still dwelling in a tent? And so that's why the motivation to build the temple. So that's really interesting, because the what we get from reading the book of Joshua, at least what's generally understood from reading the book of Joshua is he comes in, wipes everything out, and then they kind of, they start again. But you're, what you're saying is, well, no, you need to have a more nuanced reading of the biblical text, and you see that some places were destroyed, and then other places they continue to use what was there as like a blessing, really, from God.
Well, your viewers may find this interesting, but there's only three sites that the Israelites destroyed out of all of the land: Joshua, Ai, and Hazor. I mean, it would have been foolish to destroy the other cities. This is their inheritance. I mean, they're going to live in houses they didn't build. They're going to occupy cities they did not construct. You don't want to destroy these cities unless you have to. So quite to the contrary, we've only, and of course, we spent many years excavating at what I believe is biblical Ai. So I think we have a good bit of evidence of the destruction there and the destruction at Jericho and the destruction at Hazor. In fact, at Hazor right now, as we speak, they are going through that destruction level. And so it's very exciting.
Well, this also just brings up a wider thing that our viewers or our listeners would probably be interested in, just the fact that some people do believe in a couple of two different dates for the conquest of the Promised Land. You're talking about a destruction at Ai and a destruction of Hazor in the north. And people just, our listeners have to be aware of when they're trying to research this themselves, even amongst biblical archaeologists, there are differing dates for this. I'm with you. I think the Bible's very clear when these things took place. And so just for our listeners to take the word of caution when looking at that. About Shiloh itself, it's obviously, I can't not talk about the fact that Israel Finkelstein did excavate this in the early 80s for a few years. And he's one of the biggest proponents of low chronology, of kind of doing away with biblical history, David Solomon and earlier. And so it's a made up story from people hundreds of years later. That might have some elements of truth, but it's definitely not that accurate. And we shouldn't really take it seriously. You're excavating the same place, and you're claiming to find that you're finding what he didn't find, in a way.
Well, in a way, but actually Finkelstein uncovered, I think, a tremendous amount of evidence that synchronizes very nicely with the biblical text. Let's talk, for example, about Area D. Finkelstein excavated Area D at Shiloh, and there was a massive bone deposit there, a favisa. And this bone deposit was several meters deep, and about the size of a gymnasium. So very large bone deposit.
Wow.
And it's just over from the summit of the tell. And the bones within it are only bones from the biblical sacrificial system. And the pottery...
So you're talking about bones that are obviously obeying the health, the clean, unclean meats type.
Right, and that are prescribed for sacrifice.
Right, right.
Okay. So the pottery within the bone deposit is all late bronze pottery, and they're all restorable vessels. So they're all broken, but they're all restorable, as if someone had poured a drink offering out and then broken the vessel. Now, if someone is taking the late date for the Exodus and conquest, then what do you do with that? Because here we have evidence of a sacrificial system going on at Shiloh in the period that the Bible says that there was, and right by the summit of the tell, by the way. Now, Finkelstein, who at the time, I think, believed more, he was then at Bar-Ilan University, a little more conservative, and I think believed more of the text than he now does, he said that this was clear evidence of the Canaanite sacrificial system at Shiloh, and that when Israelites would have arrived there, or proto-Israelites, as he would probably call them, that they cleaned off all the Canaanite sacrifices and pushed them over the edge. To me, that's wrong on several levels. Number one, you mean these Canaanites, technically they're Amorites, but these Canaanites, they're just piling bones up? Are they savages? Why would they have massive piles of bones? But secondly, to me, I see this as clear evidence of the Israelite sacrificial system that's going on at Shiloh. It fits the time frame perfectly. This past season, we excavated a scarab of Thutmose III, which is clearly an 18th Egyptian dynasty pharaoh. Every single day at our pottery reading, we have late Bronze Age pottery. So it's clear that it was occupied during this time period. And I think that Finkelstein's Area D argues for the biblical date. So it's finding the same data, but it's how we're interpreting it that gets a little tricky.
And especially if, as you say, that we're using different dates for the different peoples in a way, then that's going to throw that way off. I want to get back to this pomegranate because I think I just left that too soon. Because as far as finding proof for the tabernacle, this is exactly what we need to find. I do want to ask, though, is the pomegranate, I'm unsure, so that's why I'm asking, is the pomegranate a feature of Amorite or Canaanite settlement, or is it just exclusively brought up in relation to the Israelite religion?
That's a very good question. We're just in the process of doing all the research right now because this is hot off the press. I've only been back home for 1 week right now. But I'm working on a peer-reviewed article already for JSRS, Judea Samaria Research Studies, and I'll have all those answers once it comes out. But I'll just say that to the best of my knowledge, there is no usage by Canaanites or Amorites of the pomegranate as a motif.
And that was,
it represents fertility, essentially.
Right, and that was, you said that was found, was that found in the glacis? Obviously not, because that would have been pre.
No.
It was found in on top of the wall or inside the,
yeah,
the wall?
Yeah, on the interior. We, for the very first time now, we have actual large interior walls from the time of the tabernacle, and one in particular that is runs perfectly east-west, and which, of course, should catch the attention of a biblical reader because mm-hmm. the tabernacle had to be oriented east-west. So here we have a very large iron one wall oriented east-west, and it was next to that wall, a few feet from it, where the pomegranate came from.
Great. Well, I look forward to definitely reading more about that for sure once that article comes out. Going forward then, we... just going forward through the history, you said, I think it was 300 plus years that this was the site of the tabernacle, but there, this Shiloh did experience a pretty big destruction, later on. How does that relate to the biblical story?
Okay. Well, this is relating to 1 Samuel 3 and 4, where the ark is sent from Shiloh to Ebenezer, which is Isbet Sarta. And there the Israelites are defeated, the ark is captured, and it goes among the Philistines for 7 months before ultimately being sent back. The Bible doesn't specifically mention a destruction at Shiloh at that time. Now, Finkelstein and his Area C had a destruction, but that was outside the wall. And so based upon that, he surmised that the whole site was destroyed around 1050 BC. And that's what's been cited in all of the literature for the last 30 plus years. However, we, in two seasons of excavation, have not yet been able to confirm that destruction site-wide. And so we may yet, you know, come to see the same thing that Finkelstein saw, but up to this point, we don't. The site could have been destroyed without being burned. But apparently, if it was destroyed by Philistines, it was almost immediately rebuilt by the Israelites, because we have found just as much iron II pottery, maybe even more iron II pottery than we have iron I pottery, which is the opposite of what Finkelstein found. In his view, there was more of an occupation in iron I than in iron II, but we've seen continuity.
Well, that's great that you've cleared that up, because... I mean, I read through the Bible as well, and I didn't see a destruction there. It doesn't talk about it. It was just assumed that the Philistines took it down when, and I guess that might have been promulgated by Finkelstein himself. So thank you for clearing that up. I mean, the Bible does talk about Shiloh being destroyed, and actually it would be a witness to the Jews in Jerusalem. The prophet Jeremiah, a couple times in his book, talks about, hey, just because we've got the temple up there doesn't mean we're going to be protected. Go and take a look at Shiloh as an example. And so it did happen, but you're saying that you just haven't found that destruction. Perhaps it was a later period destruction.
Well, that's right. We don't know if it had happened by a different time, maybe in the 722, 721 invasion. Maybe it's destroyed at that time. We don't know. But I do really appreciate what Jeremiah says, Jeremiah 7:12, go now to Shiloh. See what I did because of their wickedness. And as you said, the point is, don't think I won't do the same thing to you. So it points out to us that, number one, Shiloh is the center of Israel life for over three centuries before Jerusalem is anything, when Jerusalem is still a pagan city. So if someone is interested in early Israelite origins, then the place to look is Shiloh.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder if we could just talk about more about the excavation process while we're going, and just because we've only got a couple more minutes here. As far as Shiloh goes, you're going to be heading back there next year with a massive team again. Is that the plan?
Well, we're definitely heading back, and I assume that we're going to have strong numbers like we've had the last 2 years. Initially, I made a 5-year commitment to excavate this field that we're in, field H1. And I think we're probably on target to do that. It may take another year or two, but somewhere in that time frame. And then after that, we'll assess where we are time-wise.
And this excavation, it is open, just in case there's a listener out there that would like to participate. Is it possible for them to do that? How would they go about that?
Absolutely. Our website is digshiloh.org, and they can go there and they'll get the dates, the cost, and how they can volunteer, and we'd love to have their help.
And Chris, I was just wondering, do you have any other tidbits you want to ask?
Yeah, sure. I'll ask a question or two. What's it like in terms of logistically being able to dig at Shiloh? Is it pretty easy license-wise? I know for us working in Jerusalem, it can be a real headache, obviously, politically. And with the IAA archaeologically, it can be just a really difficult thing. So what's it like in terms of licensing and that sort of thing?
Well, it's very similar to what Dr. Mazar would be dealing with in Jerusalem. So we submit proposals to the Antiquities Authority, and then they're either approved or not approved. And we have to demonstrate our qualifications, our funding, our supporting organization, our protocols that we use, and then a track record. You know, you have to have a track record that people know who you are and what you're doing. But I can't complain. I know a lot of people feel like the Antiquities Authority is breathing down their neck, but we've had a really cooperative relationship.
Good. And also, you brought up a point earlier there about the sacrificial system and the huge amount of bones, and you said there was a lot of pottery mixed in with the bones and such. And I've just been doing personal reading about the temple sacrifices, and I found it quite interesting. From a simplistic point of view, I thought you think the altar and you think just straight animals and you don't really expect a lot of pottery. But just in some of the reading I've been doing, apparently quite a lot of vessels were used on, I guess, the altar as part of the sacrificial system. So you would expect to find a whole lot of broken, fragmented vessels. And it was even required after one use, a pottery vessel would have to be broken. If it was a metal vessel, they could purge it. So it sounds like that's what sort of was found there at Shiloh then?
Yeah, I think so. Leviticus 11 and Leviticus 15, when your pottery becomes impure, says the Lord, you must break it. And the sacrificial process makes it impure, and so then it's broken, and we do find that, I believe.
Okay, yeah, I found that quite interesting. That definitely goes along with what I've read about the Second Temple period.
And it extends back apparently into First Temple period, because the text is very ancient. You know, Moses is writing this text, so it's not that they skipped 1,000 years and then it's happening in late Second Temple period Judaism. It's First Temple and even Tabernacle period that it's being applied.
Okay. And so do you have a lot of ash material there as well from perhaps sacrificial materials? I know the Bible talks about shoveling ash away in a separate place. You talked about keeping things, I guess, hygienic in a way, because with that level of bones and such, do you find a major ash layer or just simply bones and pottery? Or
we do have ash layers. So far, we cannot say with confidence. We're working out our stratification right now. We have 9 strata at Shiloh right now, and I cannot confidently say that this, you know, ash layer pertains to this at this point. We're still working it out. But as far as in Area D, which I think everyone would agree was sacrificial, it was heavy with ash.
Okay.
And even to this day, I mean, if you go over to Area D, you'll still see the ashy matrix.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'd love to return to Shiloh at some point.
We haven't been there for, I think, 4 or 5 years, so we have to come back.
2013 we went there.
A verse for you from the Bible, Jeremiah 7:12, go now to Shiloh.
I'm not sure. I hope that context doesn't apply to me. But, we do have to make our way out there, and hopefully next year we will. Just one final question, just zooming out a little bit more. You do use the Bible as a historical source. Some people say Bible in one hand, trowel in the other. That's pretty impractical to do that as far as excavating goes while you're excavating. But nevertheless, we do talk about Dr. Eilat Mazar quite a bit because she has, even though she isn't religious, she does hold that with the biblical text with esteem and says, hey, it's the historical text that we have. Why not use it? And let's treat it as innocent until proven guilty. You are a big proponent of that, a big believer in that. What type of response do you get from internally within Israel, because that is your modus operandi? I know back in the United States, you probably receive a lot of support for that, but do you feel from your colleagues in Israel, some of them, pushback at your use of the Bible in archaeology?
Well, I would say that the Israeli archaeological community is probably split evenly between those who would see value in the biblical text and those who would not. Those who do not get a lot more press than those who do. And so there are, just dozens of major archaeologists in Israel who came to visit me this last season. They came to Shiloh. We network, we dialogue, we're comparing our findings at our site with the findings at their site. So they're very comfortable in the sort of paradigm from which we're working. I mean, the idea that because one happens to believe the text, that one could not be objective, I think is absurd. So I would be exactly like Eilat Mazar. I take the Bible as a serious historical document, just like I would take the Amarna tablets, just like I would take the Oxyrhynchus papyri or whatever. These are ancient texts, and we should use them without prejudice. And as you said, they're innocent until proven guilty. So I think that the minimalist school of thought gets a whole lot of press, and they certainly want to push back on our use of the Bible. But my idea is, guys, is we've got to engage in the arena of ideas. And my ideas, I wouldn't say are based in the Bible, but we find verisimilitude or synchronism between the Bible and archaeology. So let's engage. Let's talk about that. And if my ideas can't stand up to scrutiny, then they're not very good ideas. And so I welcome scrutiny.
Well, that's amazing. I think you're doing tremendous work at Shiloh. I feel like this is very important. And I like someone like you excavating it, because you will interpret it in light of the scripture. You're not just going to be casting that aside. You will be looking at what you're finding and saying, well, does it add up? Do I have a historical narrative that relates to what I'm finding? And I think every time that we do that, even as what is borne out in Jerusalem and continues to, the facts are there on the ground. They're just waiting to be uncovered with somebody with an open mind and knowledge of the text as well to put it together. So thank you very much personally for your work there. Thank you very much for your team. I know it takes a whole lot of effort to do an excavation. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Scott Stripling. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome. And if I can just say a final word, if anyone who's watching is interested, we have just launched a new archaeology program at the school where I serve as provost in Houston, Texas, the Bible Seminary. And they can go to our website, thebibleseminary.org, if they're interested in a graduate program in archaeology. From a conservative perspective that we've been discussing, then they can contact us.
Well, I'll make sure I put those links in the show notes as well, so people can just make that easy for them and click and go right there. Thank you again for being with us.
Okay, all the best.